So if you look at Exodus chapter 6 or chapter 7, I want to begin, first we'll set the scene, I want to begin kind of asking a question of you all. So we have the people of Israel who have been enslaved by the Egyptians, and then Moses has tried to come and deliver them, and it has only made things worse. It has only made Pharaoh angry and made him think they're idle and made him multiply their burdens and make it harder and harder and harder and harder. And we see this awful picture of these people that have to build bricks and aren't even given the materials to do that. And I think this is a, like we talked about last week or on Sunday, a picture of us in sin, under bondage to sin, and required of us a whole lot more than we're able to give, ultimately. So we see these people in harsh bondage, and God is going to deliver them. And then we see in chapter 7, begin in verse 3 with me, and God says, "But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring my hosts, my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch my hand out against Egypt and bring out my people of Israel from among them." What do you guys think about that statement there? That little section. What do you find interesting, challenging, hard, or important in those few verses? Beginning in verse 3. So are you saying to show the Israelites the weakness of Egypt, even though it provided for them, although it was enslaving them? Okay, yeah. Thank you. Other points and or thoughts about just these few verses? That's exactly right. So the point is pointed out here that the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. So the point of this is partially, is in large part, it seems, to show this bunch of pagans who God is, and then we'll ultimately see that this is spread all over the world, the stories of God and his name is spread. What else? Do you find anything challenging about these verses? I do, personally. That's why I bring it up.
Seems to say too that no matter what the Egyptians do or do not do, God's will is going to be done no matter what. He says plainly, and
I will. Yeah, that's a really good point. He will accomplish this. There's something in here that's repeated a number of times throughout the plagues that I have always found personally challenging. I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. What do you guys, anybody have just an explanation of that? We see a number of times through the plagues. The first few plagues, I think the first five, it says Pharaoh's heart was hardened, or he hardened his heart. Then the sixth, it says God hardens his heart. Then the seventh, Pharaoh hardened his own heart again. And then 8 through 10, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So we see a little bit of both, but I will say the very beginning of this, the beginning of chapter 7, the introduction of the whole of all the plagues, and then the finality of all the plagues, both begin and end saying God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So, and we as Americans, I think, often have a hard time with anything that would challenge, that sounds like it's challenging free will. So I'm interested to see what you guys have thought about that since we were last here. Oh, you go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly. Certainly. Yeah, and there's no doubt that he had at minimum six opportunities to not have hardened his heart. Byron, go ahead. He started with a hard heart. Yeah, that's a really good point.
Well, along those same lines, verse 4 says the plagues caused the plagues great acts of judgment. And it's hardening the Pharaoh's heart. I don't think it's a stretch to say it's an act of judgment against Pharaoh because of who he is,
what
he's disposed, or what he's not disposed to do.
Certainly. Yeah, very good point. Ed, did you still have? Yeah, other thoughts on that? Amy. Yeah, and I think we see that at the end, that even though Pharaoh drives them out, he still was in defiance to God again and pursues them later. Yeah, Johnny.
Said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him in letting Israel go? I do not know the Lord. What's more, I will not let Israel go."
Mm-hmm.
So, for the times of Egyptian, the Pharaoh was the god, basically, of Egypt, the way I understand
mm-hmm.
it. So, he was a god. Who is this god that you're telling me says to let these people go? I'm the god here. I don't know this god.
Total arrogance.
This is my land. This is my rule, and I do what I want to do. That's how I've always interpreted it.
Mm-hmm.
So, things that happened that God was saying was going to happen just made him that much, you know, angry, that much more boastful, that much more proud.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, his heart was hardened even further.
Yeah.
So it's not a literal, I'm going to, you know,
I'm going to crawl up inside you and force you to rebel against me. Yeah. Not making them not believe. Yeah, no, I think those are all really good points. I think the question people often struggle with this is like, okay, it sounds like God is saying that he, you know, went against, he, you know, literally made Pharaoh rebel against him. And I don't know if that's the best way to look at it, because we definitely see a number of times where Pharaoh is given ample opportunity and given mercy. He's given 10 chances to listen to what God said. But I think the best way that made the most sense to me that I've heard this explained before is, how do you harden the heart of a stubborn, arrogant teenager that doesn't want to do what you tell him to do? You tell him what to do, and that pretty well hardens their heart. And like somebody might say, "Oh, you made me mad." Well, you didn't make me mad. I allowed myself to get mad in response to whatever you did. Yeah, Shane.
And you think about James 1, where he says that you receive with meekness the implanted word. Like, if you don't have meekness, the word doesn't implant.
Yeah. That's a really good point. Really good point. Other thoughts on this? I think we've fleshed that out pretty well. You guys are all really smart. So, anyway, so I want to fly through the plagues. Just a general overview on the plagues. If you didn't notice, the plagues are actually set up in three cycles of three plagues. So we have one, you'll notice the first plague always begins with get up early in the morning and go before Pharaoh. And then the second plague always says, go to Pharaoh. And then the third one, Moses doesn't even go to Pharaoh before going to do the plague. So each cycle of three plagues, you see that pattern happening, which highlights this final plague, the 10th plague. And we even see 9 plagues and then almost like a prologue or what, I don't know, ever, you know, something, a break before you get to the finale at the end there. But I wanted to see what you guys found interesting kind of through the plagues here, what points you wanted to bring out. Yeah.
Just a general question for you. In the 4th plague, it begins to say that God is making a distinction between the Israelites and the Egyptians. Would you take from that that the first 3 plagues, they both got to enjoy the misery?
I think so. I think that's what I took away from it, because I don't know if every single one after that says it, but a number of the other ones do. And he points out at least 3 or 4 times that you will know that there's a distinction between the Israelites and the Egyptians. So I imagine that the Israelites were digging for water as well when the Nile was plagued. Unless somebody else has a better answer for that. Other thoughts or things you found interesting through the series of the plagues? Yeah. I imagine by the end of this, you still had some frog body guts and piles laying around. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly. Yeah. And that could be.
The only statement about chronology, such chronology that I remember, is verse 25 there, 7. After 7 days mm-hmm. had passed, and 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the river. And on all the other plagues, it doesn't seem to say how long.
Yeah, on the frogs, it says he'll get rid of them tomorrow, but we don't know how long they were there before they got rid of them, and we don't get any statements of after 10 days Moses went to Pharaoh again or anything like that. But it would be interesting to know, is this stretching out over a month or a couple years even, you know, or something like that. Yeah, Bill. Yeah, that's a really good point. That's one thing a theme that I want everybody to notice that we didn't really talk about. Well, we might have talked about last time, but we're going to see a number of times Gentiles testifying about God, time and time again. Just a few different ones that we see here. Back here, where'd it go? I think after the 7th plague. Oh, after the eighth plague. In chapter 10, in verse 7, then Pharaoh's servant said to him, "How long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not understand that Egypt is ruined?" So we have the servants acknowledging God a number of times. And then there was one other time I wanted to point out. Yeah, that's what I was looking for. The magicians even testify about Yahweh. And at least in the way Moses is transcribing it here, they're calling him Yahweh too, by name.
It's interesting. The whole Nile is blood. They make a little bit of our blood, and like, okay, well, he's just a better magician than we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole country is covered with lice. They make, you know, they're doing
some more lice. Yeah.
It's interesting that you think they would already see that with their little bit compared to the whole country.
Yeah, and the other thing with that is the magicians aren't able to take it away. They can only make it worse. And that's where you see Satan and the serpent in the story here is the great imitator. He can only imitate what has already been done. He can't even take away what God has done without God's will. He is only able to reproduce and make it worse. It's like when you're reading through with the frogs, and it's like, and they made more frogs came out. It's like, Pharaoh's got to be like, come on, quit it. Got plenty of this. So that's a really good point there. Yes, that the power of Satan and whatever they were able to do this by, you know, we sometimes think, well, it must have been a magic trick. Well, you know, there are also, you know, powerful spirits and things behind other things that were able to do some kind of miraculous things.
It's interesting to think about the passage that you just read that said, where they told the king the country's ruling, essentially. Mm-hmm. And imagine that if they were measuring GNP, it went to zero.
Yeah.
This was really a national disaster.
Yeah, certainly.
From which it probably took them decades, many decades, to recover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt to that. Nonetheless, that their army got wiped out at the end of it, and probably a huge population of their males wiped out there. Any other thoughts about the plagues before we kind of move on from there? What's that? No, from my reading, there's not an Egyptian history, but I think that's pretty well attributed to the fact that no nation is ever going to, you know, with the methods that they had to record things that are still around today, it was always very durable things, like things that are etched in stone, murals on walls, things like that. And I don't see what I read, the thought that was put forward is no Pharaoh would ever want to immortalize the fact that he got spanked like that. Oh, really? Gotcha.
Number two, is this more of an allegory? You know, he's just being poetic, or is this mm-hmm. actually a description of events? But yeah,
gotcha.
There's one papyrus that conceivably could do.
Okay. Well, there you go. We have some kind of corroboration. But we definitely see later on, obviously we read it in the Bible, but even like 400 years later in Samuel, 1 Samuel, we see people have still remember and have heard about what happened to the Egyptians by the hand of God. So it's definitely something that was remembered and had the purpose, as God says, that the people would know who I am. All right, so we got to kind of move on here. So let's kind of skip ahead to chapter 12 and look at the beginning of the institution of the Passover. Unless there was another thought there. So we have the final plague that's threatened on Pharaoh, that God is going to kill his firstborn son, and we have provision given to the people of Israel, and presumably to anybody that would listen to it, that they could do what? Dumb question. Yeah, they could kill a lamb, and they could follow these steps to take a spotless sheep or goat and use it as the Passover lamb. Which do we see Jesus in this in that section? Obviously, anything anybody specifically found interesting through chapter 12 there as we look at the Passover instructions given. And the final plague in the Exodus there. Yes, Norma. And instructions are given about foreigners all the way through. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good point.
There was a sense in which God actually took the Israelite firstborn also, because later in our study we'll read about the fact that he said, the firstborn is mine, and you have to redeem them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean we can jump ahead to we can jump ahead and talk about just in chapter 13 here, beginning in verse 11, he begins talking about what they had to do when he's talking about these feasts, after talking about the unleavened bread. But it says, let's look, beginning in verse 13 in chapter 13. Every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, or if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And when time comes that your son asks you, what does this mean? You shall say, by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, etc., etc. And down in the end of 15. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that first opened the womb, but the firstborn of my sons I redeem. So we see, I think, a really important point that Ed brings up is that everybody was under the death penalty here. Egyptians, Israelites, everyone. And I think that's a really interesting way that this parallels us. Everybody has sinned and everybody is under the same condemnation. The only difference between me and somebody out there is I've put on the blood of Christ. And the only difference between the Israelite firstborn child is that they had put on the blood of the Lamb. And that they had basically done exactly what we do in a very different, in a little different way there. And then we think about often Christ as the sacrificial lamb for and I think at least my mind usually goes to more like a sin offering. And Christ is definitely a picture of that, but I think we see even stronger pictures of Christ being this Passover lamb in Scripture. The Last Supper and the Lord's Supper is instituted on Passover for a reason, because Jesus is symbolically saying, hey, I am the new Passover lamb for everybody to come. And so I think that's an important part that is enumerated often in a number of places in the epistles. We don't have time to go into all of it. Sure, Norma. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And we're going to get to that when we talk about manna in just a minute here. Any other thoughts on the Passover there? We obviously don't wish we could spend more time on it, but a point that I wanted to point it out after, so we see that Pharaoh drives out the Israelites, and on their way out, they plunder the Egyptians, and that's a theme that we're going to see in future Exoduses. And basically, these people would have had nothing, and now they have all of these riches, and what do those riches end up going to make ultimately? The temple, the tabernacle, yeah, not the temple. And so, one other thing I wanted to point out as we look at the institution of the Passover and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. One example of it is in chapter 13, in verse 8. Would somebody read chapter 13, verse 8? So it says, because of what the Lord did for me is what they were supposed to teach their son when they came out. One, there's significance in that. They sang to your son, and the sons were kept alive by what happened here. But also, it just was kind of a little bit touching to me in that that's what he wanted them to be sure they said. And it wasn't just that, hey, this is because what God did for Israel. They were specifically supposed to say, this is because of what God did for me. And I know if you're like me, you're somebody who shies away from telling a personal story of your own redemption. A lot of us, especially if you were raised in the church, you can almost feel like, well, I mean, I've always kind of lived a pretty good life. I don't have this like really bad story, or I wasn't all that bad of a sinner, but this is the kind of picture that we need to see all of ourselves in. No matter how good you think you were or think you are, we got to get that out of our minds, because we have all been in this slavery, and we all need to be able to say, this is what the Lord has done for me, and tell a personal story about what God has done in our lives. But that was just something that I wanted to bring out with that. We're going to move pretty fast here. So we see the institution of these feasts, and then we see the people leaving, and they go out in their hosts and ranks equipped for battle, and God leads them to the Red Sea, and that's where we pick up in chapter 14. So what interesting happens when the people leave and get near the Red Sea? What does God have them do? Yeah, he specifically has them kind of divert from where they were going to camp in this spot where they have the sea at their backs and they're absolutely helpless. Why? So he could show his power. And it says, and that is one is the last thing that he does to I believe, harden Pharaoh's heart, because Pharaoh looks like, hey, these people are stuck in the wilderness. I might as well go and get him back. Somehow he hasn't learned yet, but yeah, Norma, you're right. And it says, 14, verse 4, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so. So we have the people of Egypt follow them out, and with this great statement that I believe we see in verse 13, and Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today." But that wasn't without the people already doubting God's ability to save them. What else do you guys see interesting in chapter 14 here as we see the crossing of the Red Sea? Yeah, so when we get a little bit further down and they talk about the hunger, yeah, certainly. And then, but specifically through this section here, anything you guys see interesting?
I have noted before that it must have taken the Israelites a good while to get across the river. Mm-hmm. And verse 20 seems to say that God intervened providentially to make sure that the two didn't contact each other during this period, get them separate.
Yeah, no, I think that's awesome. And it's interesting to me, that pillar was there as they're yelling to Moses, were there not enough graves in Egypt? that's, you know, always interesting to me in what circumstances they're able to question God. Yeah, Byron.
Well, the Egyptians are the ones who say they're horrified.
Yeah, that was exactly my next point. The next Gentile we see testifying of Yahweh in, where'd it go? 25? Yeah, and the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." So again, we see the Egyptians getting the picture and Pharaoh not. But that would have been some of their last words there. Other interesting things from this section. God's triumphed over that.
And specifically in the Psalms, he picks that up and says, we don't trust in horses, we trust in our Lord. And the irony is that then Solomon, he goes through and he gets horses and chariots, defying the order of Deuteronomy 17 of how they were not supposed to do that, because it's going back to that power source.
Gotcha. Really good point. I had not thought of that. Yeah, Johnny. Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. It's a really good point. So we see God's promise is answered, and his prophecy is answered and fulfilled in that. So then let's look at the Song of Moses really quickly. Anything interesting that you pulled out of the Song of Moses here, the victory song as they get through here? And it's like reading through this whole thing, the Israelites don't get it. It seems like each point of the way they don't get it. And finally, they're like, finally, you get it, that God has provided you salvation. And they're rejoicing in that. It's obviously a very emotional and charged celebration that they have here. I want to point out verse 13. You have led in your steadfast love the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them by your strength to your holy abode. This idea we've heard the word redeemed a whole lot, but you gotta, whenever we see redeemed, even in the New Testament, we gotta remember that is a slavery picture. That is an Exodus picture. Redemption is always from slavery. We are owned by somebody else, and God has taken us and redeemed us, paid the redemption price to take us out of that slavery. So then immediately, what happens after that? They start grumbling. Right after singing these praises to God, they start grumbling. But I think it's interesting that God is patient with them through that. We see him get definitely more angry with them later on, but he uses language more like he's testing them and teaching them through that time. Yeah, Ed?
At the end of 14, it says they feared the Lord and believed the Lord. It's just strange that they and we can be so up and down. it would look like it would stick if we behave ourselves for a longer period of time. But one day up spiritually, the next day not so.
Yeah. No, I think that. We look back at these people and say, like, how could you do this with the pillar of fire right there? How could you do this right after God threw the Egyptians into the sea? But then again, that's me, and that's you, and we do that all the time. Yeah, Shane. Yeah, no, that's something I was going to mention, but yeah, that's the picture of God reigning on the earth, and he has won his reign as king and set himself up as king in this. The parallel to that is we see Jesus on the cross, and that's is how he won his kingdom, is by going through that and leading his exodus for us and gaining his kingship in that way. So then we move on to chapter 16, and we see this big section about we see the people grumbling again for food, and with a statement in verse 3 that's just so great. Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. Man, Moses, I wish God had killed us just like the Egyptians. instead of being appreciative for what they have done. But an interesting thing that kind of sets this whole section off, we see that, that God says in verse 4, "Behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not." So what do you think, what is God testing them about? Yeah. Just like he says there, see if they're going to keep his commandment. Any other places that we see any other elaboration on what they were supposed to learn from the manna that was given them? Yeah, that's exactly right. Deuteronomy 8, 2 and 3. I mean, Byron just said it for us, but that's what Jesus quotes to Satan, which is talking about this right here, is that they were supposed to learn from all of this that man doesn't live by bread alone. So the bread, the manna from heaven, was always supposed to be to them a metaphor of living off of God, of living off of his word. And in John chapter 6, Jesus' whole discourse after the feeding of the people is all about this right here. It's all about him saying, look, your fathers ate the manna back in the wilderness, and they didn't get it, and they died. And he says that. He said, your fathers ate manna in the wilderness, and they died. And I'm here, and I am the true bread. And so this is what they were supposed to be learning, is that you rely on me, you feed on me. And that's when Jesus says, like Norma had mentioned earlier, unless you feed on me and eat my flesh and drink my blood. And that's exactly the same lesson that Jesus was teaching them then. We often think, oh, that's the Lord's Supper. But no, that's a whole different lesson. The Lord's Supper is talking about this, is a metaphor for us feeding on Jesus, feeding on his word, being enthralled in a relationship with God that these people were supposed to be learning right here. Yeah, Shane. Oh,
just
wow.
Like Pharaoh.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. God is abundantly patient. But what he does is through, you know, giving a command, we have a decision on what we're going to do with what he says. And it's that test. He's, you know, elaborating on this, on just being patient.
Mm-hmm. Good point, Bill.
It's interesting to me that some of the tests that you see in Scripture are seemingly
And it's the foolish things. God's chosen the foolish things of this world. Yeah, Johnny.
In Deuteronomy 8:16, it says, "He fed you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers had not known in order to humble and test you so that in the end he might cause you to prosper." Mm-hmm. We have to remember that that prosperity, whether it be wealth, abilities, capabilities, anything, and our spiritual well-being all comes from God. That's the mm-hmm. test, to simply prosper through him, not in above ourselves. It's not our power and might that gets us anything. Mm-hmm. It's God's allowance and mercy and grace and blessing. So that's part
good
of
point.
The test.
Yeah. And part of it is evident in just from what they named the bread. What is it? It's just emblematic of how much they didn't understand the sign there that was being given them to. Exactly right. And God allows them. Interesting. In all this testing, God allows them to hunger for a while, you know, and then blesses them after it. We see that a number of times through here. We're basically out of time. We see him give a similar test about the water, and we see this rock that later we learn in the New Testament that is supposed to be representative of Jesus. And Jesus, just as he says he's the bread of life and refers back to the manna, he says he's the water of life and refers back to the water given them in the wilderness. And we see the defeat of Amalek, who is a descendant of Esau, which is a good point to make there, and God is continually against Esau. So we're going to pick up this next week, beginning at the foot of Mount Sinai, and go through the beginning of the covenant there. It's been really good to work with you guys tonight. I did want to show you kind of just an overview of the story just thus far.